It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, renewable energy is usually a cause taken up by progressives and environmentalists. But the president of the Wisconsin Solar Energy Industries Association is actually a conservative. We'll hear his pitch to the GOP for greener energy in the state.
First, news about how Wisconsin's public schools are doing. The Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction released the state's report card for the 2013-2014 academic year today.
In the report, 88% of schools and 98% of districts either met or exceeded expectations. Only one school district got the ranking of failed to meet expectations, Milwaukee Public Schools. Here with us now to talk about the report, we have Milwaukee Journal Sentinel education reporter Aaron Richards. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So, big picture, does this report show an improvement or a decline compared with the previous years?
You know, they've had these report cards now for about 3 years for schools and 2 years for districts. And overall, we're seeing about what we saw in the last couple of years, and that is that almost everybody is doing pretty good. Milwaukee has some big challenges. Most of those stem from poverty. And for the most part, we're getting to see some other measures to help us see some things in schools we didn't know as well before, such as some growth scores, seeing how schools can move kids along when those kids stay with that school over a period of time. But for the most part, it's still a bit limited because we mostly know that higher income schools do better than lower income schools.
So before we dig into where there are problems and highlights, what criteria does this annual report card use to measure the schools?
Well, it's good to know what we had before, which was a system that looked at schools under the looked at their annual progress under the No Child Left Behind law. That was a federal law, and it only looked at how well schools did each year in having kids be proficient in reading and math. That's a pretty limited picture. What the report cards do is that they open the door to looking at some wider measures. So they're looking at student achievement, but they're also looking at how well schools close achievement gaps. And how well they're preparing kids for post-secondary readiness. So for high schools, you know, they're trying to incorporate measures like ACT scores. You know, down the road, we'll put more of these in there. And then you're also looking at things like attendance. Are kids actually coming to school to learn?
So it's a more nuanced view than the old system, it sounds like. Or that's the goal, anyway.
It is, and for parents in the community, these are one-page snapshots for the schools. They have a rating. Each school is rated on a five-point scale or a five-rating scale from significantly exceeds expectations to fails to meet expectations. Every school and district, for the most part, gets a score from 0 to 100. And so they're easier for people to look at, but also because there's more measures available, it can also kind of make your head spin if you're not sure what you're looking at.
And is this something that, in terms of accountability, if a school is in the failing zone, is there an idea of punitive measures, cuts in funding, as there was talk of some years back?
Well, the state has tried to get away from that a little bit. Of course, schools have to be held to some kind of standard because we want schools to continue to perform and do good things for kids. What I think makes people nervous is when you say, okay, well, if you're failing, we're going to cut off all your funding. For the most part, we still know that schools that struggle the most are often, not always, but often in really high poverty communities that are unstable and that have a lot of challenges. So essentially cutting off the funding stream to a school that's already high poverty may not be the best solution. What the state is trying to do is some more nuanced programs. So, for example, the state is trying to recognize schools that show high growth instead of just giving awards out every year to schools that are high achieving. We know districts like Whitefish Bay and Mequon-Thiensville are going to be districts that are higher achieving every year. The state is also trying a program that pairs up principals from schools that struggle and higher achieving schools, or schools that are performing well in a certain area, and trying to have those principals mentor each other and talk about things like leadership development. So it's more of a nuanced way of getting at improvement rather than sort of hitting everybody with a big stick if they don't make the grade on these report cards.
Well, there's been talk about Milwaukee Public Schools for a lot of years, and in this case it's the one district that failed to meet the expectations. What were some of the main problem areas that made the district fall short in this particular report card?
Well, certainly just overall achievement is a perennial problem. That would be achievement from the state tests every year in reading and math. The district also acknowledged that a big area that it lost points in is absenteeism, meaning student absenteeism, students not coming to school. On these report cards, you have to meet a minimum level of requirements in some areas to get all of the points that add up to that 100, you know, the points that add up on the 100-point scale. So, for example, you have to have at least 95% of your kids take the state test, because you could conceivably get a higher score if you only tried to have your higher-achieving students take the test. So test participation is one. So is student absenteeism. So the district said, hey, you know, we recognize we have an issue here. We would have scored better overall if we could, you know, do something about our student absenteeism issue. So that's something I think they're taking a look at as well.
And moving to the rest of the state, while a lot of districts, most districts met or exceeded expectations, there has been a lot of concern about achievement gaps. You mentioned that earlier. Do we have a sense yet of how Wisconsin schools in general did when it came to that category, achievement gaps between whites and African Americans in particular?
We haven't broken down all of that new data yet. All of the numbers just came out today, so myself and a lot of other people are still digging into a lot of this stuff. Even from last year's report cards, there has been a renewed, or at least a kind of a greater interest in this area. There's been a task force meeting since last year about this achievement gap, and it's often one that you don't see it as prominently in suburban schools where the predominant student population is white. So those, you know, the scores of white middle-income students automatically overshadow the scores of lower-income or students of racial minorities. And so there are a lot of people looking at that achievement gap right now, and there should be some more data coming out soon about that gap over time, and I suspect you'll start to hear people talk about it this week. I know the state superintendent, Tony Evers, is even coming over to the newsroom this week to talk about that very issue.
And that Superintendent Evers also posted a YouTube message about this report, and he put a little qualifier on it. He said this doesn't include things like art, music, technology. So while there's been this move to a more careful approach to rating schools, he says, hey, there's still stuff that doesn't show up here.
That's right. These report cards still don't reflect everything that I think a lot of people would find important in a school. There are even some schools in the report cards that have failing scores. Even in Milwaukee that I've been to, they're good schools. Kids are graduating. They're going to college. They're getting scholarships. And because of some of the way the measurements work out, it just doesn't make them look as good on paper, even though they might be doing pretty good things for most of their student population in real life. But Evers really told everyone, you know, hey, these are not meant to be used as a punishment tool. We're trying to separate schools so we can see who's doing well in what areas. So it gives us more measures to look at. And frankly, you know, if you want to know more about your school, go inside the door, take a look. Look at what they have to offer beyond just what's showing up on this one-page report.
Yeah, this has been going on for years, maybe decades, trying to find a way to objectively measure school performance. And it seems like we're still working on that, even with this qualifier from the superintendent of education on his own report card. When you talk to people at schools, do you get the feeling that they say, oh, great, report card, and then get back to the real work? Or is this something that they really use as part of their toolkit to figure out what they're doing?
I think that response would be determined by who you're talking to. I suspect that a lot of teachers might glance at this and say, okay, well, I get it, but you know, I'm really focused on what I'm doing in my classroom every day. In the upper levels of administration, I certainly think there's more pressure on where your school falls every year and what this report card looks like. I think that the question is still out there about whether this is helping schools improve. You know, what's my question today to the State Department of Public Instruction was, what practical effect has this actually had on schools? After 3 years of doing this, can we show that this is helping anybody improve? And I think the jury's still out a little bit on that. I think leaders are still trying to figure out, okay, what do I do now that I know this? It probably tells me some information I already knew about my school, but what do I do with it now? And how do I get other tools or extra help or assistance in some way to improve if that's what, you know, I need to do to get my score up.
And in addition to this report card, are we still using other measures? Do we still see other evaluations either within districts or statewide?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think part of the concern among teachers anyway is that we're in such an era of big data that it's largely what they're focusing on these days. You'll hear a lot of teachers say that they wish that there wasn't quite so much testing and focus on the data, because it's actually taking away from some of the time they had in classrooms to simply instruct and let kids be creative. There's a new test out and new scores out for even really young kids. It's a literacy screener that is given to kindergarten children to determine where they're at in terms of their letter awareness and pre-reading skills. There are new tests that most schools administer three times a year now to see how students progress over the course of the year. And then there's the actual state achievement tests, and those are going to be administered online for the first time this year, which is a whole new learning curve for everyone. So there's certainly just enormous amounts of data out there that we're collecting and then trying to synthesize in this effort to try to improve schools.
Well, thanks for helping make sense of this, Erin.
Thank you.
That's Erin Richards. She's education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about the new Wisconsin Public School report cards out today for the 2013-14 academic year.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Installation of solar power systems in Wisconsin has dropped since 2010. Before that, according to Midwest Energy News, the industry was growing modestly for almost a decade. Today, solar accounts for 0.1% of the state's renewable energy, barely a blip.
And with utility companies looking to raise monthly fixed rates and lower the rates at which they buy back excess solar power, advocates for renewable energy say the industry is in jeopardy.
Renewable energy growth is often seen as part of the Democratic platform, with many Republicans outright against or at least not on board. There's, for example, no mention of renewable energy in the state Republican platform out this year.
There's one very notable exception, however. Here in Wisconsin, the president of the Wisconsin Solar Energy Industries Association and co-owner of Sunvest Solar, the largest solar installer in the state, is himself a conservative. Matt Newman is a son of Mark Newman, a Republican who advocated for renewable energy and lost Republican primaries for governor and Senate in the state. Matt joins us now to talk about the solar use in Wisconsin. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, and thank you for hosting.
Well, what is the conservative case for expanding renewable energy like solar in Wisconsin?
Well, I think there's a whole bunch of reasons why conservatives should be in favor of solar, but I think the top few that are most relevant are the concepts of free market capitalism, property owner rights. It's really a national security issue if you get right down to an energy portfolio that has a broad-based method of producing energy, and then also ultimately economic development and job creation here in the state of Wisconsin. So I think there's a number of reasons. I could go down a list of a few more, but realistically, those are the core issues that I believe conservatives should be in favor of solar because of those principles that align directly with conservative philosophy.
Well, the GOP in general has dragged its feet a bit on renewable energy. And as we mentioned, the party's platform adopted this year doesn't mention clean energy at all. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there were a lot of negatives surrounding renewables in the past, and I think that has changed substantially in the last few years here. Just to give you an example, since 2010, in our own company, our cost of installations for solar systems has dropped by 65%. Meanwhile, you have utility costs going up in Wisconsin at 2.5 times the rate of inflation. So while you have utility costs increasing on everyone who has no choice but to buy their energy from the utility company, you have industries like ours that are developing primarily outside of Wisconsin and dropping our costs substantially to a point where we are now economically viable. This is no longer a discussion about needing subsidies for an industry to survive. This is about an industry that can stand on its own and compete head-to-head with utility rates.
Is there anything inherently at odds between renewable energy and the conservative platform?
There really shouldn't be. I think in the past, what it was is subsidies. I think Republicans said, we don't have the money, and I agree with them. We didn't have the money, nor do we have the money to subsidize industry, and I don't think that the government is in a position to pick winners and losers. However, if we're going to truly eliminate subsidies, we have to eliminate subsidies from the fossil fuel generating sources as well, so that we truly know what our cost of energy really is.
The case has been made by people who are a little less enthusiastic about renewable energy that it could hurt consumers who don't have it. What do you say to that?
Yeah, are you referring to the fairness argument that's being circulated right now? Yeah, honestly, there's not facts to substantiate that point of view. And that's the challenge I have with it. We're hearing a lot from the utilities right now that this is all about economic fairness, and it's about the idea that solar is being subsidized by the other ratepayers that don't have solar. Now, the fact of the matter is solar is about 0.02% of our energy mix in the state of Wisconsin. So to somehow say that that's being subsidized by other ratepayers and actually impacting the rates at 0.02% of our energy mix is just plain not true. But in addition to that, if you look at other states that have actually gone about doing a factual study on whether or not solar helps other ratepayers or hurts other ratepayers, I think you'd find, as other states did, that in fact, because solar generates a lot of its energy, about 70% of it on peak periods, there's other cost avoidance issues as well that utilities get to benefit from. The value of solar is actually higher than the retail rate that we're getting compensated for with the net metering policy. So I think if we actually go through the factual information, our state's going to find that, in fact, solar helps reduce the cost and future burden on the electric grid that we know it today.
As president of the Wisconsin Solar Energy Industries Association, do you think that you can help move the needle on Republican support for green energy?
You know, I hope so. I hope at the end of the day, the discussion is about whether or not it's an economically viable technology, because I already know the answer to that question. And I hope it's not a discussion about how we protect the bottom line of our utility companies. You know, at the end of the day, what this rate case is about, and this isn't necessarily wrong for the utilities to be doing this, but the utilities are protecting their shareholders. That's really what they're doing. And I don't blame them for doing that. It's just that they probably believe that's where their fiduciary obligation is to their shareholders. And as such, they're making sure that they have enough fixed fees being generated to cover their costs of the energy transmission. At the end of the day, we want fairness too. And all we want is a fair platform to compete on. And we want the ability, things like third-party ownership in the state of Wisconsin, which the utilities are also trying to regulate through their rate case, ironically. You know, those are types of things, financing mechanisms that allow renewables to be more affordable to everyone so that no one can say we can't pay for it. If you allow third-party ownership in Wisconsin, then people do have the ability to pay for it.
And by third-party ownership, you mean that people could buy their energy from someone who's producing it en masse, like your company?
Precisely, yeah. We could install a system on your roof, as an example, and you just buy the energy as we produce it, as opposed to you having to outlay maybe $20,000 or $30,000 to put it on your roof at the beginning. So there's companies all throughout the country, ours included, that are financing these systems for homeowners, for businesses, churches, schools, et cetera. They may not have the tax credit appetite. They may not have the ability to finance something over a 20-year time period, but companies like ours do that sort of work, and we're responsible then for the operations and maintenance of the equipment as well. So it's really beneficial for people, and oftentimes there's zero upfront cost to do that.
Do you think that the Republican Party has to somehow acknowledge climate change to bring about a change in perspective about renewable energy?
You know, I don't necessarily. And interestingly enough, I got asked this question. I don't remember the publication recently that asked me that question. And they said, aren't you just dodging the question when you say, no, you're not really sure about climate change? And the truth of the matter is, I really don't know. I have not studied climate change as an issue specifically to know whether or not that's an issue. But I don't believe that Republicans have to take a position on that, because ultimately, if we support clean energy development, we are directly helping the climate change discussion. So if it is for real, and I don't mean to be hedging on it, it's just I don't personally know. I have not studied it. I'm choosing to spend my time building our renewable energy company, which would be a part of the solution to climate change were it an issue. So I don't believe Republicans have to come out necessarily and support one side or the other of the climate change issue. I think it's more important that we support clean energy development for national security purposes and the fact that we support free market capitalism and competition in the marketplace.
With the two so bundled together, though, is that a reasonable position to take? Climate change and clean energy?
You know, I believe it is, because at the end of the day, the reason that we are in favor of and the reason our company is working so hard to promote clean energy is because I believe that we need a more broad energy mix. I believe it needs to be more distributed so that we don't have specific locations that we're completely reliant upon that, given some sort of a, God forbid, a terrorist attack or something else, that could shut down our energy grid and literally shut down our marketplace. So I believe a distributed energy grid and an energy portfolio, and one that is locally generated, is something that we ought to be working towards as Republicans, Democrats, and frankly as Americans, irregardless of the climate change conversation. And so it's not, again, it's not that I'm avoiding that topic. It's just that that's not my primary driving reason, and I don't think there should be any Republicans' driving reason for supporting renewable energy. And I don't necessarily think that might be a reason why Democrats support it, But I don't think that that should be the driving reason either. I think there's way more important issues here to be discussing.
Great. Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you for your time.
We've been speaking with Matt Newman, president of the Wisconsin Solar Energy Industries Association and the co-owner of Sunvest Solar in Pewaukee, about the conservative case for renewable energy in Wisconsin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we find out how SWAT teams rose to prominence in the United States and how their role in policing has changed over the years.
First, if you or someone close to you has been diagnosed with celiac or other kinds of gluten sensitivity, a lot of foods went off the table, and maybe the idea of enjoying mealtimes did too.
Our next guest was diagnosed with celiac over 3 decades ago. Since then, she says there have been lots of positive developments in the worlds of cooking and nutrition, and being gluten-free isn't as hard as it used to be.
Beth Hilson joins us now. She's the founder of the Gluten-Free Pantry. Her new book is called The Complete Guide to Living Well, Gluten-Free, Everything You Need to Know to Go from Surviving to Thriving. Beth, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Rob. Hi, Veronica. It's nice to be here with you.
So when you got that diagnosis over 30 years ago, what was out there in the gluten-free world to help you out?
Well, there was not much. And what there was available tasted pretty awful. So I went to culinary school so I could try to figure out how to make things over so I could enjoy them. There's a tremendous disconnect, and we have such an emotional attachment to food. And so when somebody takes it off the plate, it's pretty sad for a lot of people. But it doesn't have to be anymore. I mean, I'm sure you've all noticed, and all of your listeners have noticed, that there is a plethora of gluten-free products available these days. So it's not like it was when I was diagnosed. When I found that I had celiac disease, I felt a lot better without the gluten. But, you know, I had to kind of make over everything that I had so that I was able to eat something that was tasty. So it took me a while to put that all back together. People don't have to do that necessarily these days because companies like the Gluten-Free Pantry and so many others are now available.
It's interesting if you just take a stroll down the supermarket aisle, it seems as though it's almost trendy now to have gluten-free food. You see gluten-free labels on everything. You know, I almost expect to see them on an apple or something because it seems right. to make people more likely to buy it. Do you think that that's a good thing, this awareness of gluten-free, and maybe the fact that it is a little bit in popular consciousness too?
Well, you know, it's certainly a cornucopia for me because there are a lot more choices. And now we have two labels that are available on food products. One is, of course, the old FALPA legislation, which tells you if something contains wheat, and you know that you can't have that. But just last August, we were able to put together, the FDA passed a labeling rule that said that anything that puts gluten-free on the label now has to meet certain requirements, so it's safe for people with celiac disease. Before that, I think there was a lot of mislabeling, and people were coming to the marketplace with products that perhaps didn't meet all the standards that were safe for everybody on a gluten-free diet. But these days, I think we have a lot more safety. You notice that restaurants have a lot of products that are gluten-free or a lot of dishes on their menus. So there's so much more information. And Veronica, yes, that apple can be labeled gluten-free.
Because it
it's
is.
It's amazing because, right. But you know, there are still some gray areas, and that's why, you know, I wrote this book, so that people would kind of be able to dispel some of those myths and understand a little bit better what this diet is all about. The FDA rule says that anything that's inherently gluten-free can say gluten-free on it. But if you're newly diagnosed with celiac disease and you go to the supermarket and you see that a bottle of water says gluten-free on it or a carton of milk, you're going to wonder if that means that every other one that's not labeled that way is not safe, right? So, you know, it gets a little crazy. We need to get more definition of that, I think. Also, the gluten-free label is voluntary. So it may be something that you have been eating all along and it seems to be fine. It doesn't, it's not causing you any problems, but it doesn't say gluten-free on it. Well, that's the manufacturer's choice. And so if you still want to continue eating that, you're probably going to have to call the manufacturer and figure that out. But again, we've got so much more information and so many more products. That having been said, I do think that a lot of foods that are available to us are inherently gluten-free, besides that apple. Things like chicken and dairy products and fruits and vegetables are all perfectly safe for a gluten-free diet. And those are healthy, and they definitely should be the majority of what you're eating. And then supplement with that gluten-free donut or a piece of gluten-free bread or sandwich or cookies so that you have a balanced diet.
Well, let's strip this down to the basics. What is gluten? What is it most commonly found in?
Well, gluten is actually, you know, it's not something you can see. And actually, I think one of our, one of the comedians, the late night comedians, walked up to a bunch of people and asked them what gluten was and whether they were on a gluten-free diet. And they said they were on the diet, but they didn't really know what they were avoiding. And, you know, truthfully, you can't see gluten. You can't, you know, you don't raise it. You don't water it. It's really a protein that's in wheat, rye, and barley. So you need to know a little more information. You need to know where it hides. It can hide in things like barbecue sauce that might be made from soy sauce. Soy sauce may have wheat in it. Brewer's yeast might be made from barley. Deli meats potentially have some gluten in them. French fries are now all coated with a wheat product to keep flavorings on them. Licorice. Who would have ever guessed that licorice is made with wheat? Lipstick, lip gloss, marinades. Oh, my gosh, salad dressings. I'm discovering that a lot of I always thought that Caesar dressing was safe. And now I'm discovering that in a lot of restaurants, rather, that they use soy sauce in it. So, you know, or even nuts, sugared nuts that are put into salads in restaurants or toppings in supermarkets may be coated with wheat. So you really have to read your labels.
And envelopes, one of our producers doesn't do the gluten thing. He says, is this true? Envelopes, the ones you lick to seal, can have gluten in them?
One of the big urban myths.
Uh-huh.
For years and years, you could tell him he can lick those.
Yeah, he's going to be licking a lot more envelopes on the job from now on. Yeah. That excuse does not hold up.
You know,
so I want to ask you.
It's actually, it doesn't have wheat in it.
A lot of people are probably listening and they think, gosh, everyone's talking about celiac and being gluten-free. And you hear about some of the ailments, you know, the gastrointestinal distress. You know, sometimes I guess it can cause rashes or anemia. Or at least contribute to that. So maybe people want to get tested and find out if this is a diet that they should be following. What is it? What's involved to find out whether you have celiac or maybe you're intolerant?
Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question, Veronica, because so many people are going out there and just going on a gluten-free diet. And it's so easy to do these days. But, you know, if you have discomfort and you think that you may have celiac disease, you can't be tested if you're not eating gluten. Because the tests are really related to building antibodies to the gluten. And it's really a very simple blood test. Your primary care physician can do it. A gastroenterologist can do it. And then if that turns out to be positive, then your gastroenterologist will do a small bowel biopsy through an endoscopy. It takes about 20 minutes, light sedation. And they take a little some snippets of the small intestinal lining to see whether the villi are blunted. And if they're damaged, then they know that it's proof positive for celiac disease. There are a number of resources where people can check and where they can have their physicians check to see what the protocol is for testing for celiac disease. And one of them is the American College of Gastroenterology. They have a whole protocol for diagnosing, for testing, and then for following the diet. It's a very good resource, and a lot of physicians can refer to that. A lot of patients can refer their physicians to it as well.
So what are the symptoms what are the symptoms that might make us say, hey, I want to get checked out here?
Well, you know, that is part of the problem, Rob. There are about 300 symptoms that you can have with celiac disease, and you can have no symptoms. So about 30% of people, or adults, I would say, have the typical digestive issues. And the rest may have things like anemia, as you mentioned. Some may have infertility. You might have a neuropathy or brain fog or joint aches. There are just a number of things. And, of course, you mentioned the skin rash, which is can be dermatitis herpetiformis, which is another form of celiac disease. So it's really, if you have anything that, you know, keeps persisting or you're concerned, it's so easy to get that blood test now. And I would urge people to do that or have that physician look into it for them before they decide to embrace the gluten-free diet.
We're talking to Beth Hilson. Her new book is The Complete Guide to Living Well, Gluten-Free.
And you can join the conversation. Are you or is someone close to you dealing with celiac disease or other kinds of gluten intolerance? And what are some of the biggest obstacles that you've had to deal with? Are you looking for some advice, maybe some cooking advice as well? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now with Beth Hilson. She's the author of Living Well, Gluten-Free.
She has advice on lifestyle, cooking, dining out, and you can join the show. If you or someone in your family had to go gluten-free, how did you make that adjustment? What are the biggest difficulties? What advice would you share? Are restaurants a thing of the past for you? Call with your experiences, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. Beth, in addition to the food stuff we'll get into in a minute, you also talk kind of about socializing gluten-free, what to do when you get that invitation over for a dinner. And you want to tactfully make sure that the food won't make you sick. How do you navigate that?
Right. Well, you know, I think that to me that's always the most difficult part of being gluten-free is to talk to somebody who's kind of a friend of yours rather than, you know, in a restaurant you don't have anything to lose or gain with when you're talking to a server. And you give them a good tip if they give you good service. But, you know, with a hostess, you don't want to put them on the spot and you don't want to overtax them. So you want to make it simple. You want to ask them. I usually start by asking what's on the menu and explain that I have a special diet. And my special diet is gluten-free. And these days, it's not like it's some odd thing because everybody seems to know somebody who's gluten-free. And then, for sure, offer to bring something. And if it seems like that, you know, that the hostess is understanding the diet and can leave a portion of, say, chicken that's plain and not marinated, or can understands that you should not put the croutons on the salad, and you can leave those on the side and perhaps even leave the dressing on the side until you check and see if it's safe. That's great. But if you bring a dish, then you know that, first of all, you're going to have something you can eat, guaranteed. And secondly, that you can also share it with everybody else and they can enjoy it and they probably won't even know it's gluten-free. I usually bring a main course and something with rice or with pasta in it, and with some kind of protein so that it's hearty. And then a dessert of some sort can be anything as simple as gluten-free brownies and maybe a little pint of ice cream.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, not bad.
We're going to go to the phones right now and take a call from Susan in Racine. Hi, Susan.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call. My son is... 7-year-old son is going to be getting tested for the blood test for celiac coming up, but he also has pretty bad allergies, and we've often wondered if there's a correlation between his gut health and the celiac and allergies. So I guess if you could take my question. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. And Susan wanting to know, is a celiac needing to be gluten-free connected somehow with allergies?
Certainly there's a connection between celiac disease and lactose intolerance because lactose is digested or absorbed on the tips of the villi, which are usually the first part of the intestine or the villi that are worn away when you have celiac disease. So certainly a physician would recommend probably eliminating dairy products for the first 6 months at least when a child is diagnosed. As far as the other allergies, you don't mention, Susan, whether they're airborne, respiratory, or whether they're digestive issues or not. Generally speaking, the other allergens are not necessarily related. Some skin issues, of course, can be. I'm not a physician, so that's something that you certainly should discuss with your physician to find out a little bit more about it. But I'm one of the things that I always say to people is that when they have a number of things that they have to avoid, put a list together of the things you can have rather than the things you can't have. And so you know that you can substitute pretty easily. It's very empowering for people to know what you can have and how you can approach things in a positive way rather than saying, oh, my gosh, I can't eat here or I can't make this because it has X, Y, or Z and I'm allergic to that.
Susan, thanks and good luck to you and your family. We'll go to Patty in Eau Claire now. Patty, hi.
Yes, hi. I thought you guys might just get a kick out of this. I have a daughter who's gluten-free and dairy-free. And fortunately for her, she lives in New York City. And she can eat out pretty much anywhere where restaurants are accommodating this. She has a gluten-free bakery that's pretty much around the corner from her. Now it's very
expensive. Oh, I want to visit her.
Oh, my gosh. It's just incredible. And when she comes here, it's a little bit harder, but I am happy to say that I'm seeing more and more, even in my town of Eau Claire, with gluten-free and dairy-free options.
Interesting, Patty. Thanks for the call. Beth, are you seeing that too? Or maybe we used to have an oasis or two here and there for gluten-free availability. That's just becoming more and more the norm?
You know, one of the things that when I wrote the book, I had a whole section about gluten-free friendly cities and gluten-free friendly restaurants. And you know what? I could write a whole book on that now. I mean, it seems like it's everywhere. And people are finding that either they know somebody or they themselves are gluten-free. And so they're addressing that issue personally.
I want to ask you about what can be difficult for people who have to adopt a gluten-free lifestyle. And they love bread. What do you do about bread if you want to have a crusty loaf of something or a sandwich or something to dip in olive oil? Did you find a secret to making satisfying gluten-free bread?
I hear you. You know, when I first started on this diet, there was such a disconnect because there was nothing good out there and certainly no bread. And I loved all the European crusty bread, loaves of bread. These days, we can make them. And we can make them very well. And there are a lot of products that are available commercially that are pretty decent as well. There are a number of substitutions. I put some recipes in the book. But the trick is that if you find that you can do something that has a variety of different flours in it, like amaranth and millet and teff, and a little bit of rice flour, you're going to get more structure to your loaf, you're going to get a nice chewy texture, and you're also going to get a nice crust from it. I started out years ago, my first product that with gluten-free pantry, and one that I just adored, of course, was the favorite sandwich bread, because I wanted to have bread every day. And, you know, we've kind of grown from there. That sort of raised the bar, and I think that now the bar keeps going higher and higher, and every bakery has a better... is building a better mousetrap or a better loaf of bread these days.
You know, I wonder if you're in a household where one person is gluten-free, everyone else isn't and doesn't want to take on that diet. How do you manage things so that the gluten surfaces, knives, all that stuff doesn't contaminate the person who doesn't want the stuff?
I'm glad you asked that, Rob. It's really, you know, the blended family is, it's a little bit of a challenge, you know, when you've got young kids, because they're always, you know, the ones who don't have the gluten allergy are always eating crackers or sandwiches or something and spreading the crumbs all over, or they're double dipping in the condiment jars and then the gluten-free person ends up with a whole mouthful of gluten-filled crumbs when they try to spread jam on their bread. You know, so you need to set a few protocols in your kitchen. But for the most part, if you have things that are labeled as gluten-free or things that are labeled with gluten, in our house, we have very few things that have gluten in them. We primarily eat gluten-free. And so we draw skull and crossbones on those things that we can't, that are not allowed.
Appetizing.
You know, we have a sense of humor. So, but, you know, just so that you're mindful of that, if the person, if you have a person with gluten, with gluten sensitivity and a person who can eat gluten, you might want to have two toasters because that's really hard to clean down. But for the most part, I say, you know, equal opportunity eating is the best medicine.
We have another call I want to get to, but real quickly before we do that, what about kissing? Do people with the celiac have to be careful who they kiss?
Right. Gluten smooching, right, is what I call it in the book.
Gluten smooching.
You know, it's like, think about it, okay, from my perspective, because I'm one of these girls who might go out with a guy who has a full beard or long hair or something, and, you know, he's going to eat a pizza, he's going to eat some French bread, and he's going to have some beer, and then he's going to lean over and give me a big smooch. Well, you know what? I'm going to get a little of that bread and a little of that beer in my mouth. So, you know, just ask your date to wipe their face, maybe rinse out with a little water before you start getting a little, a little smooching going there. But there are two other areas where smooching can be a problem. And one is when you have babies who are sitting in the high chair and they're stuffing their faces with Cheerios and animal crackers, and then they reach up and they give mom or dad a big kiss, and the first thing they do, of course, is they shove their fist in the person's mouth. You know, we're next to their mouth, and it's full of gluten. So, you know, that's one area to be mindful of. The other is if you have a dog or you have pet food around. You know, how many of us don't kiss our dogs once in a while? And, you know, and if that dog has just been eating, you know, you might get a mouth full of gluten as well.
All right, Beth, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Beth Hilson. She has a new book out. It's called The Complete Guide to Living Well, Gluten-Free, Everything You Need to Know to Go from Surviving to Thriving.